Subject of the lecture this morning is, has the text of the Bible been corrupted? When I was a student at Western Kentucky University in the mid-80s, I took some religion classes when I was there, and it was all part of trying to fulfill a minor. But one of the professors that I had was Ronald Vinker, and quite an interesting man. Of course, you have to keep in mind that at a secular school, no telling what kind of religion teachers you're going to get. Many of them liberal-minded in the way that they approach the scriptures. And Professor Vinker was one such individual. I liked him personally. I enjoyed some of his lectures, but frequently he would make this sort of statement, that the Old Testament text was altered by a series of Jewish editors throughout the ages. And he'd talk about those redactors that would just make those changes. That what we have today is far from what was originally written. And upon that basis, he taught his lectures, and many of them were lectures of uncertainty. Maybe this is what was said, we don't really know. So that's the way he taught us through the prophets. But he was just simply repeating what he had heard other liberal critics say, and many of them say that through the ages, the Bible, the Old Testament, and the New Testament had been changed. When you talk about the hand copying of manuscripts through the centuries, many would say that there would be so many changes to the text because of hand copying, so many errors that would be multiplied, that there's no way that you could preserve the text. And one illustration that's given sometime is the rumor game. And I don't know if you've ever played this. We did it at like New Year's parties way back when I was a kid. You get everybody together in a room in a circle, and you have to whisper to the person next to you, and it goes all the way around the room. The first person gets just a short sentence, and they're to repeat that only once. And by the time it got all the way around to the other end of the room, it was something totally different. Every time it was something totally different. And you could start out like Tom likes to play football. Well, it would wind up Tom likes to eat bananas upside down, you know, some kind of crazy, wacky sort of a thing. And so the liberal critics would say, well, that's the way it is with the copying of the manuscripts throughout the ages. There's no way that you would be able to keep its integrity. Well, we're going to examine that and ask the question, well, is that true? Does that have any basis in truth? Has the Bible been corrupted through the ages by intentional and unintentional scribal errors? What evidence is there to show that the text of the Bible has been preserved since its individual parts were written? Now, the first part of the lesson has to do with errors in copying. Now, if I were to hand Charlie something and say, go make a copy, what do you think Charlie's going to do? Well, he's going to go over to the printing place over here and run it off, and he's going to get an exact duplicate, all right? But they didn't have Xerox machines back then in the early centuries. You had to hand copy everything. And so if it was something real short, perhaps somebody would just copy it themselves. If it was a book, they might hire a scribe to do the copying. That was the job of the scribe, to copy text. And the scribes that we read about in the New Testament, remember the scribes and the Pharisees, their job was simply to copy the Old Testament scriptures and to preserve that through the ages. But as you indeed make hand copies, sometimes you might make an error in copying. If I were to hand you something and to tell you to hand copy it, are you going to say that I'm not going to make any mistakes? I'm going to be flawless in the way that I copy. Occasionally there will be errors that crop in when hand copies are made. I like what McGarvey said in his book on evidences of Christianity, and that's in your outline, that the integrity of a book is preserved when it has been transmitted without material change, that is, change which affects its meaning. I think that's important for us to understand. We may also affirm the integrity of a document when, though material changes have been made in it, we shall have detected these and restored the original readings. When you talk about textual criticism, that's a study of manuscripts. And the purpose of that is to see what differences may exist in the various copies of the same text. Because in hand copying, there'll be slight alterations. All right, what are those differences? Textual criticism identifies those. And textual criticism also tries to determine from those copies what the original said, though the original would not be necessarily available. Now, We talked some yesterday about the way in which the Jews preserved the text and the meticulous methods they went through to make sure that the copy was near or identical to what they were copying from. According to the Talmud, which is a Jewish document about AD 350, it says that the Jews adopted for themselves very minute regulations to preserve the purity of the sacred text. They numbered the verses, words, and letters of the scriptures by books and sections, marking the middle verse and letter of each, so that by counting these in any copy, they could determine whether a word or letter had been added or omitted. We talked yesterday about that and also about the Masoretes, how they were quite strict about their copying methods, and our Old Testament text is based upon the Masoretic text. I think it's also interesting to understand how the Jews viewed the copying of manuscripts, that after a copy had been meticulously made, they valued the newer copy more than the old. Because in time, the old copy that they had for so many years would become damaged by use, frayed, some parts would fall off of it. And so they were so meticulous, they valued the new copy more valuable, that this is preferred than the old. And in the Jewish synagogues, they had a cabinet of wood, a gehenza, that they would put the older manuscripts in, and they wouldn't use them anymore. And when that wooden cabinet became full, many times they would take the manuscripts out and burn them. And of course, we today, we like to see if we can find the oldest manuscripts. We put a higher value on them than they did necessarily. But they were so confident in their copy methods that it didn't matter to them what happened to the older manuscripts. There's a verse that I don't have in your outline here that I had in my other one, but I didn't cover it the other day. That's Romans chapter 3. I think we ought to consider that today in this lecture. Romans 3 and verse 2. Romans 3 and verse 2. Now, in the context, Paul is making the point that it doesn't matter if one is circumcised in the flesh. The circumcision that counts is that of the heart. In Romans 2, Paul points out that the Jews were guilty of sin, just as the Gentiles were back in Romans 1. So what is important is if we obey the Lord from the heart. And so Gentiles who obey the Lord are in favor with the Lord. And so the Jew would say, well, what's the advantage that we had? And Paul says in verse 2, well, let me read verses 1 and 2. What advantage then has the Jew, or what is the profit of circumcision? Much in every way, chiefly because to them, that is to the Jews, were committed the oracles of God. The word committed means entrusted. Oracles of God means the sayings of God. They, as a group of people, were entrusted with the preserving of God's word. And as a group of people, they fulfilled that trust. Now, of course, they didn't always keep the law as far as following it. In fact, Stephen said in Acts chapter 7 and verse 53, you who have received the law by the direction of angels and have not kept it, you've not followed it. As we mentioned yesterday, Jesus never rebuked them for adding things that shouldn't be to the text or taking things away. That text was preserved. Brother Keith quoted from verse 4 in Romans 3. And let me read verse 3 first. For what if some did not believe? What if some didn't believe what was written down? Whether unbelief make the faithfulness of God without effect? Will it nullify God's faithfulness? Certainly not. Of course not. Indeed, let God be true, but every man a liar. As it is written, and this is a quotation from Psalm 51 and verse 4, that you, speaking of God, you may be justified in your words and may overcome when you are judged. Or if you go back to Psalm, it says when you judge. So here it says that though man may disagree with God, God's always right. God's word has been preserved to judge men who disagree with God. And so Paul here doesn't say that, look, you Jews just botched it up. You messed up the text. No, the text had been preserved. And it has been preserved. In regard to the New Testament text, of course, the New Testament is composed of the Gospels and the Epistles primarily. And these things were written And if you turn to Colossians 4 and verse 16, see something that Paul told the brethren at Colossae when he sent that epistle to them. He said, "Now when this epistle," this is Colossians 4:16, "when this epistle is read among you, see that it is read also in the church of the Laodiceans, and that you likewise read the epistle from Laodicea." So he said, once you read this that I'm writing to you, you know, I like the Laodiceans to read it. It will be to their benefit. And I've written them, and I want you to read what I've written to them. So necessarily, copies would be made. That here, brethren in Colossae would read what Laodiceans received, and those in Laodicea would have a copy of what the Colossians received. And in 1 Thessalonians 5:27, Paul said that he wanted his words to be read to all the holy brethren. So if you lived in the first century and you were a Christian, you would want a copy of what you knew was inspired of God. Because if you understood the value of Scripture, that it could make you complete, thoroughly equipped for every good work, that is profitable for all those things that we talked about yesterday, you want a copy for yourself. Peter said that he wrote down his words so that they might remember what he taught. And certainly the Christians would want to remember that. You would want a copy of these epistles for yourself. So hand copying would be made of these things. And I think it's logical that if you believe that what you're looking at is inspired of God, you're going to take great care in making sure you have an exact copy. You're just not going to do a half-hearted effort. You're just not going to approach it, "I don't care if I make a mistake." You want to be exact in that. And I think the Christians would have been careful in that. But in spite of careful copying by Jews in regard to the Old Testament and Christians in regard to the New Testament, there would be some textual variations. There would be some mistakes made in copying. It was inevitable. And this is true of any work of antiquity. It doesn't matter what you're talking about. If you study manuscripts of Homer or whatever, there are going to be textual variations. That's a standard thing. You shouldn't be surprised at that. In the outline on top of page 50, I give the different types of mistakes that can be found. These are logical. When you make copies, sometimes you might misspell a word as you write down your own copy. If you're writing in dictation, that this is a way sometimes in which texts were copied, that you have a person in the room reading the oldest copy and then everybody else listening to that, writing down. And that way you could make multiple copies at once. But it might be that the writer didn't quite hear properly what was said, misunderstood, and wrote something down just a little bit different. Or if you have somebody copying, there might be something else going on and they're distracted. And here you have a moment of inattention and they accidentally make an error in their copy. There are other mistakes there possible that could be made listed in there. There might be some intentional alteration. Somebody might say, "Well, I'm going to intentionally make a change because I see in this manuscript I'm copying, there must have been a mistake in it and its copying, so I'm going to try and correct what I see to be maybe an error in there." Or somebody may be dishonest and say, "Look, I think I'll change it to more fit what I like." Some of you are aware that we started an experiment, and thanks to Oscar, who really got that rolling down there in Alabama, and appreciate those brethren down there for getting that started. What we did is I wrote a fictitious epistle, just a little bitty short thing, and sent it to Oscar. The instructions were that the brethren were to take this is an experiment, were to take this and hand copy what's there. And so 10 people took that and hand copied. And then Oscar took two of those and made a second generation. And we kept making new generations. Some of you participated in that here. Some people from Canada did, and people from all over the country. And there's some manuscripts that haven't been sent to me that are in Kentucky right now. So the experiment will be ongoing. And basically, we wanted to find out if the text could be preserved. This is the tree that we have so far, and this is the original document, and here's that first generation and then that second generation, and we've just got it going and going. these things that are in purple, I named each document with a random number letter sequence so that later we could just take them and maybe see if we can identify which generation it is by what's there, identify any families of documents and so forth. But this is the actual tree. Those things that are in purple, they are identical in every detail to the original. And there's a bunch of them there. It goes all the way to the fifth generation, still having copies identical to the detail. These things that are in red or have red behind them, some of these little errors cropped up. What's interesting is that we have identified a family of manuscripts because we have some errors in this manuscript up here, this 99BI, that were perpetuated all the way down. It'd be easy to identify that family of manuscripts. And so you can see there are little bitty errors here and there. So how is it that you account for these little errors in copying? How do you determine what the original said if you don't have the original or don't have the first generation? Well, you compare it to all the other available manuscripts. And I think these little mistakes can be easily identified. And that's the science of textual criticism. As far as how the experiment turned out, and again, it's ongoing, and there were 41 copies. Of the 41, 26 of them, that's 63% so far, were perfectly identical to the original. 15 documents contained 41 errors, and I counted it the way that people typically count errors, even though they're perpetuated. It doesn't count as one error perpetuated. It's every time it's perpetuated, it's added to or counted as an error. And how this turned out is as much how documents are as they're studied, the biblical manuscripts that are out there, that the most common individual error are misspelled words. Those are easily identified. And that one early manuscript that we pointed out, here we have these perpetual errors that you have one word addition and one word omission perpetuated 8 more times in that family. Another word addition in that same early manuscript was perpetuated 7 more times. Somebody later recognized, hey, that's not right, and fixed it, corrected it. And that accounts for 26 errors of the total. One mistake was a word substitution, and that was not perpetuated. One mistake was an omitted phrase. One mistake was a repeated phrase. I want to show you an example of that before we jump to the conclusion. Here's some examples of that. And there's a lot I'd like to say, but don't have the time to, about a lot of these copies. There were a lot of fascinating things that stood out to me. But here's that instance where a phrase is repeated. And I don't think I mentioned this earlier, that as one is copying a manuscript, they go back and they're looking at the one they're copying from, and they go back a line. They connect with a different word and start writing. This happened here. As it reads, the doctrines to confuse the weak among us, drawing the weak among us, drawing. You see the repetition there. I underlined that in red. That's easily identified, and sometimes that happens. We see those in the biblical manuscripts that are available. This person admitted a long phrase. Likewise, brother, we have God. Well, there were a lot of different words in there because the original was... Let's see if I can find that. Okay. Likewise, brother, we have... Here's what's missing. We have endured hostility from those who claim to be children of God. All right. And they omitted a lot. Likewise, brethren, we have God. But you see, even in that mistake, that's not in error doctrinally. It's not teaching false doctrine. And in most of the cases that you have textual variations in Bible manuscripts, doesn't affect doctrine at all. Doesn't affect it at all. Let's see. Well, this is the case of somebody adding a couple of words and it doesn't change the meaning and leaving one out. Those were perpetuated. But don't have time to go into that in detail. But putting this back up here, again, in only one case was the meaning affected, and that's what we just talked about, the omitted phrase, and even then it was not doctrinally an error. Every mistake could be easily identified and corrected by manuscript comparison. There was no problem, even if we didn't have the original. that the integrity of the text was still preserved after five generations. And those are the results of our little experiment. And again, I want to continue that. I want to multiply those and see what other things that we come up with. All right, we need to see what the manuscript evidence actually says. And in regard to the Old Testament, we talked about it a lot yesterday, about its recording and preservation. And again, we're in this lecture answering that charge that throughout the ages, throughout the centuries, the text has been altered and changed so that we cannot know what the original is. Let's talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls for just a little bit. I'm not an expert on the subject, but like Brother Welch said when he's here, I can read a book on it and learn that way. But here is the area in which the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. Qumran. Here's the Dead Sea, and the area is right in here where those caves were found. And here you have a wadi, which was a place where a river was. It's a dried out area. And in this cliffside over here, you have these little caves. And there were a lot of Old Testament manuscripts that were put into those caves, perhaps by the Essenes. And a shepherd boy was looking for his lost sheep and threw a rock into one of the caves, heard a strange sound. Well, the next day they went in there and found that they'd broken one of these pots that contained these documents. They didn't know what it was at first, but later it was discovered what they were. And this is not a good picture, it's out of focus, but there's some caves there in the side of the cliff. It's kind of a close-up of the area right there. Here's a picture of what one of those pots looked like. Of course, they put it together. It was in pieces. Really, you have an entire library in those caves. Over 800, I think, manuscripts. And that's just not counting the fragments of manuscripts. There are several thousand of those. And in there was found an entire scroll of Isaiah. Here is a page of that. It's well preserved. And here's the larger scroll there. You can see there's some wear and tear with age. And these things date back to the time before Christ. About 200 years or so on up to, there's some documents there that go up almost to the time in which the Romans came into the area. But you compare the text to what we have today, and there's no material difference. It's the same, essentially. There's not been a corruption of that text over time. Fascinating discovery, and I have in your outline that it was in 1980. I think it's actually 1979. Now, this is the only picture I could find of that, and this is the weirdest picture I've ever seen, because it looks like that guy's about to get hit by McDonald's apple pie. But that's a silhouette of the discoverer of this, okay? And that's not that big. I mean, it's two pictures imposed on one another. That thing is probably about that size right there. There were two silver scrolls that were found in 1979 in a tomb near Jerusalem by this guy, Gabriel Barke. That's his silhouette. And these are the oldest known fragments of the Bible. These things predate the Dead Sea Scrolls by 400 years. The text that's found there is Numbers chapter 6, verses 24 through 26. And it dates back before the Babylonian captivity and the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. These scrolls, made originally out of silver, they might have been worn as an amulet or something like that. And some of you have been over to our house and seen that the original owners of our house were Jewish, and that on the doorways you have the little things there where you have the little scrolls inside of them. Of course, we broke one of them open. We've got a little bitty scroll in Hebrew, a passage in Deuteronomy. And this is kind of what this is, but the passage is in Numbers. Let's take a look at that real quick. Numbers chapter 6, and this is the priestly blessing. Somebody was carrying it around, wearing it. They liked the passage, or maybe it was common back then for people to do this. Don't know. This might be a precursor to the phylacteries. Don't know. But Numbers 6, verses 24 through 26, this is what it says on there. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make His face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up His countenance upon you and give you peace. Now, the piece of document is so worn that there's a little bit of it missing. But what's there is this. And the text has not changed. It's the same. It's the same. And that's just proof that God's Word has been preserved. As we said, Paul in the first century said the Jews had preserved the Word. In regard to the New Testament, I think we should mention before we cover this in greater detail on what material were things written in the first century. So they didn't have paper. They couldn't go and buy a ream of paper at the store. But they could make sheets of papyrus. And here's a papyrus plant right there. And what they did is they took the stem of the plant right here, which is kind of flat, and cut it into strips right there. There's an example of that. And here's what the papyrus plant looks as you back away from it. But what they would do is they would put the strips down. And notice that at first, if you can see this, the strips are this way. They laid them together this way, long ways, put them together. And then they put another set that way, horizontally, and put it together. And there's some natural gum or whatever you call it in the plant that helps that. And they had ways of making sure that stayed together. And so when that dried, they wrote on it. And a lot of the New Testament manuscripts that have been found are written on papyrus. Later, you'll find documents written on parchment, which was animal skinned. They took the hair off of it, put it on a device like this, and smooth it down, sand it down, leave it up to dry, and then after it dried, they would cut it into sheets, cut off the edges of it that weren't straight, and then begin to write on it, and then bound it in such a fashion as this. Now, if somebody was rich, they could afford one of these. But most Christians weren't rich. And we don't see a lot of parchment until in the later centuries anyway, especially toward the 3rd and 4th century. One example of that is the Sinaiticus, which is from approximately the 4th century A.D., and that's on parchment, and those preserve a lot better than the papyrus do. And the Sinaiticus is a codex in the form of a book. It's currently in the British Museum in London, and this was found at a monastery on Mount Sinai. And it contains all the books of the New Testament and contains a large portion of the Greek Old Testament. And here's just a close-up of the Song of Solomon. You see, all the letters are capitalized, and there's no spaces between the letters, which is a common way to write at that time. And this kind of document is called an uncial. And so this is an important document because there are a few translations that base their text heavily upon it and upon this one, Vaticanus, from about the 4th century A.D., and it originally contained the whole Greek New Testament and Old Testament. And some portions of that have been lost. But it's a fancy document that dates to approximately 325 to 350 A.D. Now, I'm going to show you pictures of a lot of other manuscripts. Now, one of the things that we mentioned yesterday is that there are liberal scholars that say that the Gospels, some of the New Testament books, were not written until the late 2nd century A.D. or 3rd century A.D. And that's a comforting thought to them because they think, well, if it's written long after the events took place, then it must be inaccurate and contain more myth about Jesus than fact. Well, do we have manuscript evidence that takes us into that time period that they say that there's a gap? Absolutely. Absolutely. And what about these manuscripts? Do they show that the Word has been preserved during that time? Well, let's take a look at these and go backwards in time. This is a papyrus codex, and it contains 1 Peter, 2 Peter, Jude, and a couple of Psalms. And it's guessed that this was put together for a private individual who put some other secular works in there, just put stuff in there he wanted, bound it together. But it's from between AD 200 and 300. Now, I looked at different sources for some of these. there were people who tended to want to date them later and people who tended to want to date them earlier. So I put the span on there so you'll know. But the point being is that these things show that there's not been any errors introduced into the text since that time. This is part of a codex. This is just one leaf. And on there, it has the end of Luke and the beginning of John right there. There are 51 leaves of this left over from that book. It contains portions of Luke and John. And we can see that, yes, this existed during that time. The text has not been corrupted since then. This dates back to AD 175 to 200. This is, as you can see, parts of Matthew, and you may think that you're looking at ink blots at this point. But here you have one side of this, and here's the other side, front and back. And, of course, this is just all that's left of this, but parts of Matthew 23 are found on there. All right, can we go back even further? Why, of course. AD 150 to 250, roughly. By the way, you might see in the outline things like P45. That just means papyrus document. It's number 45. It's what it's catalog number and so forth. But it contains these chapters in Matthew, these chapters in Mark, these in Luke, John, and Acts. Of course, it's an incomplete document, but those things are there, and the content of it is consistent with what we have today. This dates back to somewhere between 150 to 200, 104 pages of a codex. We have lots of the Gospel of John in there. You can see that it's in the form of a book. And so John did exist during that time, and things have not changed in our text since then. This dates back between 125 and 200. This is a small little bitty piece of Philemon, but it's unquestionably Philemon, as they look at that and say, well, that Greek that we can see fits what's written in there. Here's the back side of it. And so here are portions of Philemon existing back at that time. Okay. So we continue our slideshow here. This is the front and back of a very frayed document, and papyrus documents tended to do that over time. But what's on there is unquestionably words from John chapter 18 and 19. I apologize if I'm going fast, but try and fit this in the time. This dates back to AD 100 to 200, and it contains a lot of Paul's epistles, all of them to some extent, except 1st and 2nd Timothy, Titus, and Philemon. They figure that there are almost 20 pages missing out of that, and probably would have contained a lot of these others. So here you have Paul's epistles contained together in a book there during the 2nd century. Here's evidence from Matthew. And here's the front of this little fragment in the back of it. And it's from Matthew 21 over here. And a little bitty, there's a few words on this one. I don't know if you can see it, but it's from Matthew chapter 23. And again, the few little words that are on this are consistent with what we have today. This is the most popularly talked about fragment. This is the John Ryland's papyrus. And it dates back, and again, there's a lot of dispute. And so between AD 98 and 130, here you have John 18, various parts of that. So we're getting real close to the first century, aren't we? Okay. So what does that say, for instance, about John? That it wasn't written in the 2nd century AD or 3rd century AD. Because we have evidence of it existing before then. Well, you want to go back even further. Now, the liberal scholars don't like the early dating on this one, so they 200. But this could go back almost to the time of the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Some conservative scholars say it fits in the way that the Greek letters are written and so forth. I wouldn't know about that. But that's what they say. And here you have this portions from Matthew. It's like a puzzle. You have pieces that are missing, but these would go right here. And this is just the front side. The back side has other parts of that, unquestionably from Matthew. All right, this is one that's very much in dispute at this time, and the verdict is still out on this. And there are some who say this is from somewhere between AD 50 to 68. And this is centimeters, so that thing is really small, okay? And there's just a few little Greek letters on that. But it contains a combination of letters which can only occur in the Greek word Gennesaret, which you find in the book of Mark. And that the other little letters on there don't fit any other text of that time but Mark chapter 6. So again, the verdict is still out on that, but it's very interesting that we continue to see evidence that the New Testament was written close to the time of the events that it records. Now, as far as the number of manuscripts, this is just a drop in the bucket. I've just showed you a few. But I want you to make a comparison here. I think this is important. There are only 7 ancient manuscripts found of the works of Plato. And your historians will say, well, that's sufficient. We have what Plato wrote. No problem there. 7 from Plato. Tacitus. All right, we have 20 manuscripts of his annals, what he recorded, history of Rome. Nobody disputes that. We have his annals. Though there are many textual variations in there, we can know what was written. Aristotle, there are 49 manuscripts of his writings. No one questions that. And it's preservation through the ages. Sophocles, there's 193. Homer's Iliad, there's 643. Wow, that's a lot. And that is a lot for works of antiquity. What about the Greek New Testament? How many manuscripts are available? And this date is current as of the beginning of this year. That's constantly updated, and I haven't seen the latest on that, but 5,715. Now, do we need evidence? We have a lot of evidence, don't we? We have a lot of manuscripts to compare, to see. And what we've seen, the integrity of the text has been preserved. And this tells me the Greek New Testament was popular too. People saw it. They wanted copies of that. A lot of copies made. There was a reason why it was popular. And you know what that is. And I have another chart up here. And this just goes to show that the number of manuscripts found keeps growing. And back in 1884, as far as papyri, I don't know how many back then, but the uncials where you have the all capital letters, there were 163 available then. As far as lectionaries, that is, you had commentaries and so forth that quoted from scriptures, you know, you can compare those, 540 minuscules is kind of the cursive writing in Greek, 1,997. That was available back in 1884. Well, what about 2004? Well, so much more. And as we said, the number grows. The evidence grows. And if we look at the evidence honestly, we will say that we indeed have the Word of God preserved for us today. There's no reason that we should doubt. And as Peter says in 1 Peter 1, verse 25, the Word of the Lord endures forever. Thank you for your attention.